This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. New whistleblower allegations rile House Democrats. Auto workers strike across the Midwest and the South. President Trump takes on California. And NPR loses one of its founding mothers. There's lots to discuss this hour on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in studio is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, a congressional correspondent with the New York Times. Cheryl, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
James Antle is editor-in-chief of the American Conservative Magazine and a former politics editor with the Washington Examiner. James, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thanks for making time for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me back.
We'd like to make time for your questions and thoughts about this week's news. And oh boy, was there a lot of it. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Politics is going to be the big block for the top of the show. We will talk about more than just politics, but there was a lot of politics to talk about, Cheryl, and I want to start with this whole whistleblower story, because that's moving as we speak. Can you first of all just give us the basics on this? It involves politics and Congress and the president and unnamed sources and possibly a foreign government. Can you just boil it down for like the 60-second basic kind of core of what this story is?
Okay, so here's what we know. We know that the Intelligence Community Inspector General is investigating some kind of unspecified complaint from a whistleblower involving President Trump and a foreign leader. We at the New York Times are reporting that it has to do with Ukraine. But after that, it's a lot of connect the dots. We know that the president has been pressing Ukraine to investigate corruption in that country and has sort of insinuated that Ukraine would have a better relationship with the United States if it would do so. We know that allies of the president, including Rudy Giuliani, have been pressing Ukraine to investigate one of the president's political rivals, Joe Biden, who was overseeing Ukraine policy as vice president when his own son was involved in some business dealings in Ukraine. So this kind of raises the specter of possibly some kind of quid pro quo, and that would go straight to the question of an impeachable offense. If the president, and let's make clear, we don't know this, but if the president was involved in some kind of trying to entice Ukraine to investigate Biden in exchange for more support for Ukraine, it could speak to things like high crimes and misdemeanors, and the Constitution specifically mentions bribery.
And can we speak at all, Cheryl, to how the Times kind of pegged it to Ukraine? Is there anything we can say about the sourcing?
I did not report that story. The sources were not identified in the Times beyond sources familiar with it.
Okay.
So the answer is no, I can't say anything about the sourcing. But I will say one other thing. There's a clash going on between Congress and the Inspector General. Congress wants the report. The acting director of national intelligence has apparently directed the inspector general not to give the report to Congress. So we're also seeing kind of a constitutional clash here.
Yeah, James, Congressman Adam Schiff of California, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, says he was not properly informed about the complaint, wants some answers. He talked about the complaint yesterday after meeting with the inspector general. Here's part of what Chairman Schiff had to say.
We do know that the Department of Justice has been involved in the decision to withhold that information from Congress. We do not know because we cannot get an answer to the question about whether the White House is also involved in preventing this information from coming to Congress. We do not have the complaint. We do not know whether the press reports are accurate or inaccurate about the contents of that complaint. But what I do know is this: if in a matter within the jurisdiction of the Director of National Intelligence, you have an employee of that community or a contractor or detailee who follows the law and makes a complaint, and it is possible for the subject of that complaint to essentially quash the complaint or keep it from Congress, then this system is badly broken.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, speaking yesterday. Jim, what do we know about kind of the back and forth of this? I mean, the president, I don't think, has said a lot about this week. There's just been a
right.
kind of a resounding no from the administration.
Right. I mean, President Trump tweeted out essentially that is his main platform for communicating to people. He tweeted out essentially a denial, or at least said that obviously he wouldn't say something so dumb or inimical to American interests, especially with questionable people listening in to his conversation. So clearly that didn't happen. Obviously, Rudy Giuliani going on CNN and appearing to confirm aspects of what people are speculating about the contacts with Ukraine, but not quite confirm them, but sort of confirm them, really added some fuel to the fire. And there's been an overarching issue with congressional Democrats in their oversight of the administration requesting information from the executive branch and getting resistance to getting this information. And so this is just the latest example of that. And I think that given the state of the administration's relationship with leading congressional Democrats, including people like Jerrold Nadler on the House Judiciary Committee and Adam Schiff, there is going to be real pressure to get to the bottom of this.
The president tweeted just about an hour before we went on the air again about this whistleblower campaign, kind of pushing back against the idea that there was anything wrong.
Right.
The president, in a two-tweet comment, wrote, quote, "The radical left Democrats and their fake news media partners, headed up again by little Adam Schiff and batting 0-for-21 against me, are at it again. They think I may have had a quote-unquote dicey conversation with a certain foreign leader based on a quote-unquote highly partisan whistleblower statement. Strange that with so many other people hearing or knowing of the perfectly fine and respectful conversation, that they would not have also come forward. Do you know the reason why they did not? Because there was nothing said wrong. It was pitch perfect," unquote. That's the tweet that the president sent about an hour ago. With regard to the pitch perfection of that, Anita, that kind of brings us to what Rudy Giuliani said last night on CNN in an interview with Chris Cuomo. We were going to play a cut, but I can just sum it up simply. Chris Cuomo asked Rudy Giuliani, "Did you do this thing that might have caused trouble with the president's comments with Ukraine, ask them to dig up dirt on Joe Biden?" And Rudy Giuliani said, "No." And then about 4 seconds later, he essentially said that he did. What?
Right. Well, Rudy Giuliani often says one thing and then says another, much like the president does.
But this one's pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. And he did not appear to think that that was a bad thing, right? That he was asking the Ukrainian government to investigate the president's political rivals. But we don't actually know if this has anything to do with that. I mean, there's a couple other things brewing here. The vice president spoke to the Ukrainian leader this week. The president's supposed to meet with him next week when he's at the UN General Assembly. So that raises some eyebrows there. And remember, it wasn't too long ago that Congress was worried and other people were worried that the administration was slow walking aid to Ukraine, military aid, financial aid to Ukraine. And we weren't really sure what was going on with that. And then the money went and the aid went. So there's a lot of different things going on with Ukraine, and it's a little bit unclear what this is about. The president, though, in his tweet, and he previously tweeted about this, is referring to something where most presidents don't have calls with foreign leaders that other people aren't listening to, right? On the foreign leader side, you have to assume that some of those aides are listening. And even with President Trump, other people are listening to those calls. They're in the room. They're offering on speakerphone or some other kind of, line. So he's saying, well, people know what I said, and it was fine. But clearly, someone thought that there was some issue there and brought it to their attention.
James asked on our Facebook page, "I thought the inspector general had discretion here, but the DNI was required to report to Congress. Am I mistaken? Is the DNI required to report this to Congress?" Cheryl, I think that's part of the issue, right?
That's the question. What is the requirement? Is the DNI required to report to Congress? Obviously, Adam Schiff and other members of Congress are saying yes, and the DNI, or in this case, the acting DNI, is saying no, and we don't have a clear answer to that now.
It's a little different than if it was, say, the Secretary of Labor, like the Director of National Intelligence.
Yes.
It's a different kind of office that, like, lives squarely within the purview of the presidency.
Yes, exactly. And also, let's not forget, this is not the Department of Labor. This is not the Department of Education. This is intelligence. This has to do with the most sensitive, secretive aspect of any administration, of any bureaucracy. And so And we know that Congress is a leaky sieve, right? I mean, everyone knows that.
which is probably going to end up back in court again, so many other things.
So, you know, the administration wants to keep close hold on this.
With regards to what comes out of that leaky sieve, Sharon tweeted, "We're staring at an impeachable offense while Trump and his enablers try fervently to obstruct the House." Jim, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. I mean, asking a foreign government to dig up dirt on an American political candidate is a capital one no-no. However, there's also been the pushback, and Republicans made this case during the hearing, particularly with Corey Lewandowski, which we'll get to in a minute, that the Democrats are still looking for something. The Mueller report wasn't the smoking gun. They're still looking for a smoking gun, and they're praying, cross your fingers, that Rudy Giuliani's slip of the tongue last night will finally be the smoking gun.
Yeah, I think that this is another chapter in a sort of story of the Trump campaign and its interactions with foreign people, foreign governments, trying to find dirt on their political opponents, then accusing their political opponents of doing this very much the same. It's an interesting dynamic here because obviously if there's a quid pro quo, raises real problems for the president, but they also want to get this Hunter Biden and Joe Biden stuff out there, and it isn't out there to the same extent that some of Hillary Clinton's scandals were.
We'll continue in just a moment with James Antle, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, and Anita Kumar. Also wanted to pay some homage to Rick Ocasek from The Cars, who died on Sunday. Here's one of his hits, Just What I Needed. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, James Antle of the American Conservative Magazine, and Anita Kumar of Politico. We'd love your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's get to one more question about this whistleblower story, and then I want to move on to talk about Corey Lewandowski. Robert in Easton, Maryland asked, "What are the ramifications if either the whistleblower or the intelligence inspector general go public with the details?" Anita, I think that going public with national security information is a federal crime.
Right. I think it depends on what they're going public with, right? So if it's classified information, information that shouldn't be out in the public, that's an issue. If someone wants to bring something to the public's attention, they're allowed to do so. It's just the question of what that information is, and we just don't know. We don't know enough, I think.
Let's talk about Corey Lewandowski. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings this week. Cheryl, I think this was the first, if not one of the first, actual hearings related to the potential impeachment process. But this went sideways kind of from the beginning. Lewandowski was pugnacious, to say the least. He just didn't give a damn. He was going to make life hard for the Democrats from top to bottom and just kind of sit quietly while Republicans said, this is stupid. It's a fishing expedition. We don't really need to be here. Did we learn anything from this hearing, or was it just kind of like a few hours of Lewandowski, you know, sparring with Democrats?
I think we learned a little bit, not as much as Democrats would have liked to learn. Lewandowski did confirm the account that was in the Mueller report, in which President Trump had a conversation with Lewandowski to instruct Lewandowski to tell Jeff Sessions, the then attorney general, that he was going to limit the scope of the Mueller-Russia investigation. So Democrats were very eager to get that information out of Lewandowski because they believe that it establishes or goes a ways toward establishing that the president obstructed justice. But that's all they got out of him. Pugnacious is probably an understatement for the way Lewandowski treated members of Congress. There was one particularly nasty, I guess, exchange with Eric Swalwell, the California congressman who had been was running for president, and Lewandowski refused to read that the words from President Trump out loud. Swalwell said, "Are you ashamed?" He said, "I'm not ashamed." At one point, Lewandowski referred to Representative Swalwell as President Swalwell. So it was quite nasty. And Lewandowski was also under orders from Trump not to disclose any private conversations with the president. And he abided by those orders. He didn't, beyond confirming the account that was in the Mueller report.
So, Jim, was this a win for Corey Lewandowski? I mean, he went on CNN's New Day the next day and had a really rough interview with Allison Camerota and just kind of like bodied her live on national television and started asking her questions about, well, what about the press and what about this person and what about James Comey and why aren't you people? And it was a Twilight Zone episode really fast. Like, I think he knows there's nothing they can do to him.
Well, you have to remember that Corey Lewandowski has political aspirations himself. He is going to be running as a Republican for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire. There's precedent for this being a successful strategy in Republican politics. Pat Buchanan really became a national figure because he was very assertive and combative in his testimony to the House on Watergate, defending President Nixon. Oliver North played a similar role in the Iran-Contra hearings, defending President Reagan and himself and his own conduct in that scandal. And so Corey Lewandowski, I think, was taking a page from both of those gentlemen who really became pretty important conservative figures out of these kinds of confrontations with members of Congress. And with the Republican primary electorate, there is a premium for getting in fights with the media. I mean, Newt Gingrich won the South Carolina primary in 2012 largely because he yelled at a debate moderator during a debate, and it did not have much momentum prior to that. So these are things that I don't know that Lewandowski is going to be able to replicate the things that have been done in the past, and I think that Jeanne Shaheen is going to be a pretty tough person to beat, but certainly there's not a lot of downside.
Jeanne Shaheen, the incumbent in New Hampshire.
The incumbent in New Hampshire, a Democratic senator in New Hampshire. There's not a lot of downside to getting in a fight with Eric Swalwell or a CNN anchor in Republican politics right now.
Anita, we also learned this week that there is a newly named national security advisor to succeed John Bolton. Robert O'Brien was formerly chief hostage negotiator. The president named Mr. O'Brien the new national security advisor. His main order of business is dealing with the situation in Saudi Arabia and relations with Iran, and he has been critical in the past of the Iran nuclear deal. What else do we know about and expect from Robert O'Brien?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of an interesting pick. It doesn't differ all that much from John Bolton, the former national security advisor. He's not such a firebrand, though. I mean, he has those same conservative views, but he doesn't wear them on his sleeve. He doesn't have to insist that something is done his way. And I think what we're going to see is the difference is personality. The president says they get along very well. He seems, from all the reporting that's been done and people that know him, that he is more easygoing. He's not going to push his agenda. He's not going to push those policies. Even if he believes in them, he's going to be someone who is letting different people say what they think in a room and letting the president make a decision. And that's really what the president wants. And so that's what he was looking for.
Jim, let me come back to you for a second with regards to a trip that President Trump took this week along the West Coast. Spent 3 days on the West Coast with a mix of campaign fundraising and attacks on California state policy. Now, while he was there, he threatened to revoke California's authority to set vehicle emission standards that are stricter than the federal government, those California emission standards. Right. He made that official on Thursday. California's Governor Gavin Newsom tweeted, quote, "See you in court," unquote. Now, Jim, the president froze the federal emission standards last year, the federal standards. In July, four major automakers signed a deal to comply with California's standards, which are stricter than the national.
Right.
What is the point of this? I don't know anyone who wants dirtier cars. Is this actually about auto emissions? Is this just politics because California is an easy political punching bag for President Trump? Like, what is this?
I mean, it's a little of both. I mean, obviously, President Trump believes that looser environmental regulations are in general better for economic growth and job creation, particularly in some of the manufacturing areas where he's trying to goose employment and where some of the swing voters who turn some typically blue states red for him are employed. But yes, some of this is obviously a political punching bag. Trump has no real chance in California. California was a major source of Hillary Clinton's lead in the national popular vote in 2016. It's not a state where he's really vying for their electoral votes. So I think going after Gavin Newsom, and before Gavin Newsom, he was going after Jerry Brown. Certainly, again, again, sort of like fighting with CNN and House Democrats investigating Trump-Russia stuff, there's not a lot of downside among Republican voters for picking these types of fights.
And a great place to fundraise. There's still some deep Republican and conservative
pockets
in California.
There are a lot of Republican donors in California. There are not quite so many Republican voters. Well, raw numbers, I guess there are a lot, but percentage-wise, not very many.
And Cheryl, while he was in California, the president said that the EPA would take action against San Francisco for pollution coming from the city's homeless population. Now, as a former San Franciscan, this is sensitive because homelessness in San Francisco is literally a humanitarian crisis. It is the most heartbreaking thing in the world to walk through this gorgeous city and see people literally doing their bodily functions on the sidewalk as you're making your way to the cable car platform. So this is not a joke. What's up with this?
You know, honestly, I think this was mystifying on so many levels. First of all, we know that this is frankly not a president who really is that interested in improving the environment. So let's say this was an environmental concern and not a humanitarian concern. President Trump wouldn't be the one to fix it. But what this really suggests to me is the president's way of looking at cities. He is not looking at homeless people as people who need to be cared for, as people who need to be uplifted. He's literally looking at them as trash that needs to be swept away. And he talks about, we can't let our cities go to hell. Isn't it terrible that people who go to work in our beautiful buildings have to step over homeless people? And I'm trying to sort of reserve judgment here, but it is somewhat mind-boggling.
Although, you know, it's funny, Anita, I have heard some of my friends back in San Francisco who are like, I really hate President Trump, but San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has not done enough on homelessness. So if this is the thing that shakes them up and makes them go, no, we'll handle this, then I might be inclined to listen.
I saw some of the reaction you're talking about where some people were saying, hey, we do need to do something, but they're not really sure they want this to be the way, mm-hmm. right? They don't want it to be President Trump. But yes, I think you're right. I think you just cannot separate what is happening with the president with the politics of California, though. And we just mentioned it. Nancy Pelosi is, he's criticized her. San Francisco is part of her district. He has talked over and over about sort of fighting with California, and they've done it right back, right? The Attorney General of California has so many lawsuits against the federal government on a variety of things, including the environment and immigration. And I just think you can't separate the two.
And the Attorney General's predecessor, Kamala Harris, then went to the Senate and is now running for president.
Right.
John wrote on our Facebook page, attacking California plays well to Trump's base. Everyone knows what the San Francisco dog whistle means to them at this point. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. There was another story this week, and it revolved around something from the New York Times. So, Cheryl, let me come back to you. There were some Democratic presidential candidates who demanded that Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh be impeached in response to an allegation of sexual misconduct that the Times reported over the weekend. Before we get into the politics, could you just give us the summary of what the story reported?
So the story was actually essay in our Week in Review section, our opinion section. So it wasn't a news article. It was written by two authors, Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, who've written a book about Kavanaugh. And what they reported was that there was another allegation against Kavanaugh when he was a freshman at Yale, in which a woman accused him of exposing himself to her. And that this allegation came from classmates who had brought this information to members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, including Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons received this information and wrote a letter to the FBI saying that he would like the FBI to interview, in particular, one former classmate of Kavanaugh's, someone named Max Steyer. And according to Coons, the FBI didn't pursue it. Now, I want to make clear that there are questions about whether or not that account has been corroborated. The woman in question did not talk to these authors. But nonetheless, there was a to-do over Chris Coons' letter to the FBI, which raised questions about the scope of the FBI's background investigation into Kavanaugh at the time that Kavanaugh was being accused by Christine Blasey Ford a California professor of having sexually assaulted Blasey Ford when they were in high school. And important to note, Kavanaugh has denied all of this.
Right. And Cheryl, Republicans have seized on the notion that the woman involved in the alleged incident told friends that she doesn't recall it, right?
That's exactly right.
Jim, on Sunday morning, the president tweeted that Kavanaugh should, quote, start suing people or the Justice Department should come to his rescue, unquote. Two Democratic presidential candidates, Senators Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, have called for Kavanaugh's impeachment. Other Democrats walked away from that really quickly. What do you make of the politics around all of this, particularly the use of the I word?
Well, the emotions are still raw about the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation because people had very strong feelings on both sides of it. I think a lot of Democrats believe that Kavanaugh got away with what he allegedly did to Blasey Ford and perhaps other incidents. And I think a lot of Republicans believe that he was falsely accused, that he was smeared, and that there continues to be a pattern of smearing him and making accusations against him with limited to non-existent corroboration and loose evidentiary standards. And so this was just another episode in that. And I think a lot of these perceptions existed without the need for a new allegation to be made. You know, there are still a lot of Democrats who are upset that he was confirmed despite the allegations, and a lot of Republicans who think that there was an attempt that narrowly averted to railroad Kavanaugh. So politically, I think there is some, when you have a lot of Democrats vying for progressive support in the primaries, there is going to be some kind of upside, I think, to taking a firm stand on this and using the latest reports to maybe reevaluate Kavanaugh, to get people debating and talking about Kavanaugh, to maybe even try to talk about impeaching Kavanaugh. I don't think that's going to go anywhere, but certainly it's something you can talk about when you're running for office in a Democratic primary.
We're going to move on and talk business in a minute, but Anita, this I word, the impeachment word, keeps coming up with this hearing at Corey Lewandowski, with this article about Brett Kavanaugh. And I don't know. I just wonder where politically that's going to go, where this thread of like, it almost feels like, well, we got to impeach somebody. There's so much wrong going on. Like, we got to get somebody.
I don't know. You saw the Democrats say, we can't take this on about Kavanaugh. We're dealing with the president right now. We can't do too many things. I think they've sort of let that go. They're focused on the president of the United States now. There's arguing in the Democratic caucus about what they want to do and how far they want to go. But it's clear now that they're very much looking at a variety of investigations. And they are, you know, as the Democrats said this week, this was the Corey Lewandowski hearing was the first impeachment hearing, as they're saying.
And we've heard, like, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said, we don't want to think about impeachment. She's, you know, if anything, she would like to see the president imprisoned rather than impeached, or at least, defeated for re-election.
You know, the speaker has to think about all these political considerations, and there's so many vulnerable Democrats that don't want to hear that or have to vote on that. She knows there are not votes for this in the Senate. I mean, it's a very practical thing, even though some of her members don't really like that. But she feels like that they have to continue to investigate.
We'll talk business when we continue with Anita Kumar of Politico, James Antle of the American Conservative Magazine, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times. Before we pause, one more story that made news this week. Season 28 of Dancing with the Stars is underway, including with former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. He banged on bongos and twirled to the Spice Girls' 1997 hit Spice Up Your Life. He was dressed in a lime green ruffled shirt and white pants. Very chic, although white after Labor Day. That should be 2 points off right there. But President Trump's critics denounced ABC for just having Spicer on. They argue that it normalized someone who defended the president's lies and misstatements. On a scale of 1 to 10, the three judges scored Spicer's routine a 6, a 5, and a 5, total of 16. Middle of the pack for the premiere, but far from the lowest score that night. We'll get back to the roundup in a minute. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Cheryl Gay Stolberg, James Antle, and Anita Kumar. One story we're watching is the flooding in Houston, in and around Houston, caused by Tropical Depression Imelda. Some areas in southeastern Texas and along the Gulf Coast have been drenched with more than 3 feet of rain. That forced some chaotic evacuations and left a lot of people stranded. So far, local authorities have attributed 2 deaths to flooding caused by the storm. We're keeping an eye on this story with help from our 1A Across America partner station, Houston Public Media. Let's talk business. After one of the nation's big automakers watched its production grind to a standstill this week, 50,000 workers at General Motors walked off the job at facilities in 9 states on Monday morning. They want to end pay and benefit disparities between full-time and part-time or temp workers. Michigan Radio spoke to part-time GM employee Jesse Kelly. This is how Jesse described the working conditions.
They have a way of pitting you against a permanent employee where you feel like if you go the extra mile, if you work a little bit more than your union brother or sister, that that will give you an opportunity to eventually get hired in full time. And that's not the case.
That's GM employee Jesse Kelly speaking to Michigan Radio. Anita Kumar, I wonder what your sense is of how big a deal this strike is.
It seems like a big deal. This is a lot of workers. It's a lot of workers. I was reading that, you know, this is, they haven't been involved in a strike like this. We haven't seen something like this in a decade or more, probably since the last recession. So I think it is a big deal. And it's a big deal that some of these workers are, full-time permanent workers are siding with these temporary workers. I think that's a big deal also. But I think it's going to be more, I was hearing that people are sort of, this is resonating with people. A lot of times we talk about the economy and how well it's doing, and it is doing pretty well, but that there are a lot of people sort of left behind that aren't doing as well. And I think this resonates with those people that are saying, look, we still need other pay and benefits, and people aren't really realizing that when we keep hearing about how good the economy is doing.
With regards to it resonating, we heard from Sean, who wrote on our Facebook page, I work for Federal Mogul Powertrain in South Bend, Indiana. We are looking at a work shortage due to the auto worker strike. Some of us, myself included, have already been asked to not show up to work today. This strike affects more than just GM plants. I support the union workers, but am hopeful this will be over with ASAP. Cheryl, what about that? Is anyone kind of rising up to say, let me intervene in this, let me help resolve this, or is this still kind of very much in the hands of GM and United Auto Workers?
I think we're going to, we'll see whether or not anybody steps forward. But one thing that I've been thinking about with respect to the strike is that this strike kind of plays into this broader conversation that we're having in the country right now, political conversation that we're having over workers' rights, over the little guy versus the big corporation, over who benefits from, let's say, President Trump's tax cuts, over whether we should have a $15 minimum wage. You can see this strike sort of becoming part of the conversation that we'll have, let's say, when Elizabeth Warren or a Joe Biden or a Bernie Sanders is running against President Trump. And as Anita said, I think we're seeing a lot of upset in the country about workers. Yes, the economy is doing well, but people are still struggling in some of the swing states where the auto industry is prominent, states like Michigan and, also Ohio, these kind of factory states. And that's the strike, I think, is emblematic of that.
I think you're right, Cheryl. And James, I think it is interesting that this is happening at a time when both President Trump and the various Democratic presidential hopefuls are trying to appeal to blue-collar workers. President Trump, because that's a part of his base, and Democrats, because they know that this is part of the demographic, this is part of the wave of voters who left them in 2016 and prevented Hillary Clinton from winning. So this really strikes at the heart of something that is super important to President Trump and to Democrats.
Yeah, and these may well be the voters who decide the 2020 election, given where they're distributed in the country. These are the swing states that are really in play. These are also the voters that the top-tier Democrats are really making an effort to reach. They're President Trump needs to retain his blue-collar support. He needs to cut into Democratic margins in union households if he's to be reelected. So it is pretty important. And also, it does speak to something structural in the economy and the way we currently value work, that we're having a large-scale strike at a time where we have record low unemployment, at a time where we have, you know, fairly robust economic growth, maybe some signs of cooling, but the economy is doing relatively well, certainly better than it's done in a number of years. And we're still having a lot of conversations about, are people being justly compensated? You may be employed, you may have a job, but are you making enough money to make ends meet? And that's going to be an important discussion to have in 2020 and beyond.
Well, and Anita, to that point, I wonder if that means that because this is so important politically, that the president and the candidates are going to spend time kind of focusing on these workers, focusing on them, as opposed to helping them. Like, someone is going to have to set politics aside for a minute and think policy if they want to get involved. But these voters are kind of a perfect photo op to show up at the picket line and show yourself shaking hands with and talking to voters, as opposed to saying, okay, let me put my campaign on hold for a second. Let me put politics on hold for a second and get you back to work.
It's hard to separate policy and politics.
For real.
I do think the Democrats are going to be hearing them side with these workers and talk about these workers and talk about what this means. You know, the president hinted the other day that he could get involved in a different way. He's talking about maybe he could get involved and help solve this. He tends to say that a lot and sometimes gets involved and sometimes doesn't. So, you know, I do think we're going to see this, especially if it drags on even further. I mean, we're already into a week here, and it really depends on how long this goes on.
Let's move on to another business story, because the markets were a little bumpy this week. There was a surge in short-term interest rates of up to 10% earlier this week, and then the Federal Reserve jumped in to try to calm the markets. Cheryl, talk about what happened with the Federal Reserve and kind of how the markets reacted to that.
Well, so the Fed decided to lower its interest rate by, I believe, a quarter of a point or so. And this is their concern, basically, about a softening economy. President Trump is pushing them to do more. And this, I think, is a very interesting clash between the president of the chairman of the Federal Reserve and the president. You don't often see a president take on the chairman of the Fed in public. But after Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, announced this, Trump basically accused him on Twitter of being weak-kneed. He tweeted, "Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve fail again. No guts, no sense, no vision. A terrible communicator." Trump wants them to lower the central bank rate to zero, I believe. And the Fed is, you know, not yet willing to do that.
Now, Jim, what's the president's case for lowering the Federal Reserve rate to zero? Why does he want to do that?
Well, he clearly wants to make sure that the economy is growing as rapidly as possible. And he thinks that any tightening of money, any rising of interest rates is going to be contrary to that goal. It's going to make the economy slow down. And he doesn't see any threat of inflation. It's really interesting because, number one, Powell is a Trump appointee. And two, Republicans have traditionally been sort of tight money people, not necessarily wanting high interest rates, but there's been resistance among a lot of conservatives under the Obama administration and before that to the idea that we should be pursuing growth through zero interest rates, through quantitative easing, through methods of growing the money supply like that. So this is a bit of a departure. And we saw Ronald Reagan sort of accept a lot of the tightening that was done by Paul Volcker, who was not a Reagan appointee, when he was chairman of the Federal Reserve, even though it had short-term negative effects for the economy and helped raise unemployment at a time that was politically very bad for the president, President Reagan, because they lost the 1982 midterm elections because of a slowdown. Trump is not working in tandem with Powell here and is lobbying him to do more to goose economic growth.
Anita, one other business story that caught our attention this week had to do with Purdue Pharma, the company that makes OxyContin, owned by a very wealthy family called the Sackler family. On Sunday evening, this past Sunday, Purdue Pharma filed for bankruptcy, which got a lot of people's attention because, of course, Purdue Pharma is trying to settle cases related to the opioid crisis. How does this bankruptcy filing affect things? It seems to blow everything into a completely different path of progress.
Right. And the company was asking this week the judge that's overseeing it to let them pay out money, salaries to employees that they felt did a good job or had done good work. And you saw a lot of people saying, well, wait a minute, what about all these families that are affected, all these lawsuits relating to OxyContin? So there is a lot going on there where people want the company to say, no, we're going to put these people first, all these different people across the country that were harmed. And so there's going to be some kind of fight. But, you know, the judge does oversee this. So it will we will see who ends up getting some of this money, whatever's left.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. This week, we said goodbye to two legends of broadcast journalism. Soon after 1A launched, I had coffee with Cokie Roberts, one of NPR's founding mothers and one of this program's first fans. She told me that even she was racing to keep up with this unprecedented political era, but she also made me feel more confident that this program could handle it. Cokie Roberts died on Tuesday after fighting breast cancer. Last fall, Roberts shared this guidance for young women in journalism during an interview with the Television Academy.
I would say what I do say to younger women all the time, which is duck and file, meaning don't get all involved in the politics of your institution or in competition inside your institution or with other people. Just do your work and get it on the air. And then people will see that you're good, if you are.
That was Cokie Roberts in conversation with the Television Academy. She lived to be 75. Cheryl, I know you had thoughts on Cokie's life and her legacy.
Well, I do. First of all, Cokie was a real role model for women journalists in particular. She was a creature of Washington. Her parents, both her parents were members of Congress. Her mother succeeded her father. Her father was Hale Boggs, died in a plane crash. But I want to share this story, a more personal story of Cokie. A friend of mine whose husband died of leukemia recently had a small fundraiser at her home for cancer research. And Cokie was the featured speaker. And Cokie came, and she was already ill herself, but she came and she was so eloquent and elegant and wonderful. And Joshua, this fundraiser happened last week. It was, in retrospect, when I heard of Cokie's death, I realized this was such an incredible gesture on her part to do this. And I think it really speaks to the kind of woman that she was. And someone that I think all of Washington will miss her. America will miss her. Journalists will miss her.
Quite a few of you have also told us how much you will miss Cokie Roberts. Phil in Michigan emailed, I just want to say that I and everyone else that listens to Morning Edition will really miss Cokie Roberts. She was a walking history book. Every week, people would call in with political questions, everything from constitutional law to presidential history. She had the answer and was always very informative. And after she gave her comment, I came away feeling more educated. She will be missed. We also said goodbye to another journalist who helped cover some of the nation's political giants, including the Kennedys. Sander Van Oker of NBC News helped moderate television's first presidential debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960. He was also the very first TV reporter to interview Jackie Kennedy.
If it's not presumptuous, Mrs. Kennedy, what about your role as a mother and a wife? Can one have a role as first lady? We haven't had a first lady who's had young children for such a long time. Are you optimistic about fulfilling this role in the same way you did before?
Yes, I think it doesn't matter what else you do if you don't do that part well, if you fail your husband and your children. That really is the role which means the most to me, though obviously I have a deep sense of obligation for the others, but that's the one that comes first.
Sander Van Oker and Jackie Kennedy's very first TV interview. He died on Monday and lived to be 91. Mrs. Kennedy is actually very helpful for the kicker for me because Merriam-Webster released some new words for the dictionary, and there's one word in particular that I'd never heard before, but it applies to Jackie Kennedy. See if you can figure out what it means. The word is rhotic. R-H-O-T-I-C. Rhotic. It applies to Jackie Kennedy.
Are we guessing?
Mm-hmm.
Does it have something to do with her diction?
I'll give you a hint. You would have a non-rhotic dialect if you said things like, Pak the ka in Havid Yad.
I was close. It
you're pretty close.
To do with her diction, yes.
Exactly. A dialect of English is rhotic if it pronounces the letter R.
You must have already known that.
How did I know that?
Wow. I'm impressed.
So
I'm
that
a good
was a
guesser.
Rhotic and non-rhotic marriage is what we're saying.
Exactly. Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times. Cheryl, 10 points for getting the vocab test right, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Joshua.
James Antle with American Conservative Magazine. James, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Anita Kumar of Politico. Anita, enjoy your weekend.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We leave you with the ending theme from the animated comedy The Boondocks. That show, based on Aaron Magruder's comic strips, took on tough topics like race and class and stereotypes. It ran to critical acclaim on Adult Swim, and this week it was announced that it would be coming back for a 2-season revival on the new streaming service, HBO Max. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. You can learn about our team at the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.